KC2RIW.
Yes, KC2WQB. Yeah, I hope I can explain this one to you. Maybe you can tell me what was going on. I have a DC high pot tester. I know you know what that is. And I was checking out the a piece of glass, which on both sides of the glass, I had two pins, approximately about a half a millimeter away from the glass on both sides. And when I got up to about 80,000 volts, it would, what I thought, perforate the glass. Now, I wanted to have your explanation. Do you think glass is self-healing, or doesn't it track? Does it actually make a perforation through the glass when it does that, or does the glass just become conductive? I know it's an insulator, but eventually it will conduct. Because what happened was it would break down. Now, normally when something tracks, the breakdown voltage gets lower and lower as each test is made. It would stay at around 69,000.
You decided to do the test, the high pot test, with, you said, two pins. I presume that means something like two straight pins. I wonder if you had two large, round, bulbous objects on the end of the probes that you could have used instead of pins. When you go to a number like 80,000 volts with sharp, pointed, pinny devices, even without the glass there, you're going to get a breakdown. You're going to get corona discharge, particularly from the one with the negative voltage on it. So to really test the dielectric strength of the glass, you'd have to be using some kind of a large, round object for the probes, not a sharp, pointy pin. I know, logically, you think the sharp, pointy pin is going to tell you, hey, is this part of the glass got good voltage breakdown compared to that part? I want to resolve the good and the bad parts. Logically, you think you can use a sharp, pointy pin. You cannot, because the corona discharge of the sharp point will take place even without the glass present. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Dick, I did have the two Klystron bulbs. They're about an inch and a half in diameter. And I used those as probes. I could not penetrate the glass. I had to actually concentrate it with the pins. That's what it seemed. That's the only way I could get it to go through the glass.
Yeah, you thought you were testing the glass. You were testing your probes, John. When you had the inch and a half diameter bulbs, and you put them on opposite sides of the glass, and you got absolutely no breakdown, you have just proved that your glass does not break down at that voltage. You didn't need the sharp point. The sharp point creates an apparent breakdown that is not the glass. It looks like the glass. It's not. If the glass wasn't present, and you had those two pins there in air, guarantee you would see a corona discharge. I wonder if that's what you saw, John. Go ahead.
Well, without the glass, I'd have to move them pretty far away because it would just break down instantly. But with the glass in between, it did not break down until I got that voltage up pretty high, and it went right through the glass. I mean, I could see it going from pin to pin, unless that was just an illusion.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio.
Please don't be sure that that was an illusion. Stand by while the ad goes by.
Link active.
Now, reasonably sure, John, that that was an illusion. It looked like it was going through the glass. Any reasonable piece of glass, let me pick a number, 1/16 of an inch or more, is not going to break down at 8,000 volts. I'm not sure, but I'm guessing that glass is good for, 30,000 volts per centimeter is air. I'll bet you glass is good for at least 500 kilovolts per centimeter. Good glass. Because of your sharp point, you were creating a local corona discharge that really didn't involve the glass. You could have put any material there, glass, plexiglass, polycarbonate, Teflon, any known good high voltage insulating material. And with two sharp points, a short distance apart and 80 kilovolts, you're going to see a corona discharge. And you're going to think the material under test is discharging. You can only do that test with large, round objects testing the material. Because if you plot the voltage gradient that exists around each of those probes when there's a sharp point, right at the sharp point, you're asking the air to have a ridiculously high volts per centimeter, which it doesn't have. You could do that sharp pointy test if and only if the whole apparatus was in a vacuum bell jar and you had sucked out all the air. Then you could do that test, and you'd really be testing the glass every millimeter at a time, if you know what I mean, as you moved it across those two probes. But your air was giving you the discharge, not your glass, in my opinion. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Question. Okay, Dick, what was happening, as I would bring the voltage up, you would get that normal hissing like on a TV when it was damp, you get the corona discharge. But then, when I got up to 80,000 volts, it made that snap, just like a second anode lead discharging, and it looked like it was going through the glass. I mean, it was a pretty loud. I was afraid to go with the spheres because I would have to bring the voltage up so high, I was afraid of blowing the glass apart, and I didn't have my mask on. So that's interesting. I'm going to try that again with the round ones at much higher voltage.
How big was the piece of glass? How thick was the piece of glass?
It was approximately 20 inches square, and it was normal window pane thickness, maybe a little thinner.
It's possible. I'm having trouble with that one. And you think the discharge, the snap, was taking place through the glass. Do you have any other known high-voltage materials you could have tested, like Teflon, polycarbonate, plexiglass, or whatever, mica? Do you have any other high-voltage materials you could have put there instead of the glass? Over to you, John.
I tried Kevlar and a few other plastics. I believe one was nylon, not Teflon, and it did not go through the nylon. And I think glass has a higher dielectric than nylon, but the nylon was a little thicker than the glass. So I'm going to have to do a little better note-taking next time. But I could swear it was going through the glass, and I don't know how to prove it. I was thinking of putting a piece of paper on the glass to see if it actually burns a hole through the paper, looking at it through a microscope. But my question was, it wouldn't continue. If it was making a hole in the glass, the dielectric quality should be going down, and it should arc at, say, 50,000 volts the next time, but it wouldn't. So I don't know whether it was self-healing or what was going on. It just mystified me. I thought maybe I'd run up by you and see what you thought.
I don't think the glass was self-healing. And was the glass really breaking down? Maybe. I'm not sure. And the fact that it would break down at 80,000 volts over and over again is interesting. And I agree with you. If you really created a hole in the glass, any kind of physical damage to the glass by that breakdown, it would break down at a much lower voltage on the next experiment. I think you're saying it went to 80,000 each time. Your particular HiPot, I presume it can measure picoamperes of current flow, and if the fact that you get a snap, a loud popping sound, implies that it's backed up with a capacitor on its power supply, and when it does break down, all that high current is going through the circuit that can measure milliamps, nanoamps, picoamps. How does the circuit protect itself? Give me some words on your HiPot. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
This is a Biddle machine, and it'll go up to 100,000 volts. This particular one is DC, by the way, Dick, not AC. The AC's a monster. They're brute forced, and they weigh about 1,000 pounds. This one only weighs about 100 pounds. I believe you're right. It charges up, and you can set the trip current, and it was tripping out. I set it for 200 microamps. So while the corona was being generated, there was very little current, but she tripped immediately as soon as that snapping arc happened.
What's the highest and the lowest you can set the tripping current? And is there a meter telling you what the current is while you're doing the experiment?
Yes, there's a microamp meter, which you can change up to, I believe it goes up to 2,000 microamps.
Okay. Okay, 2,000 microamps, I think is 2 milliamps. So 2 milliamps is the maximum current. What's the maximum sensitivity? What's the minimum current the meter will register, John? Go ahead.
About 10 microamps.
You can set it anywhere from 10 to 2,000 microamps of trip current, but the meter, does the meter have more than one scale? Does it always read 0 to 1 milliamp full scale or something like that? Go ahead.
There's a range switch in, I believe it's hundreds of a microamp. Yes, and there's several positions on that. But the meter only reads like from 0 to 2, and then you calculate from there.
Okay, the meter reads 0 to 2 somethings, and by the scale, you can select what that something is. And so I guess the scale switch is setting full scale current. What's the maximum full scale current? What's the minimum full scale current? You can dial in.
I can set it for a trip at 100 milliamps. That's the minimum trip, I believe. And over that, I think it'll go up to like 1999. It won't go to 2,000.
Yeah, but John, I'm not asking for the trip current. I'm asking for the sensitivity of the Dawson valve meter. And you've got a range switch which sets its full scale current. You're really setting the shunt on that meter. When the meter is in its most sensitive position, how many microamps is it full scale? And when it's in its least sensitive position, how many microamps full scale on the meter? Go ahead.
If I remember correctly, Dick, I think it's 50 microamp sensitivity actually on the meter itself.
Agreed. That's the meter movement itself. But is there a range switch that changes the scale of the reading of that meter? Over to you, John.
Yes, there is. That's a in decades of 100, I think it is, 100 microamps.
Okay, so it's in decades of 100. If it's set in the most sensitive position, I think you're telling me it's 50 microamps, because it's a 50 microamp movement. If it's in the least sensitive scale, which moves 100 at a time, how many milliamps or microamps is the least sensitive movement? What's the maximum and minimum full-scale deflection on that meter? Over to you, John.
From 100 microamperes to 2,000 microamperes, I believe it is.
Okay, so you can set it to continuously read leakage current even though it hasn't hit the trip number. And when it hits the trip number, I presume what the machine does is it records or holds its position, holds that meter movement or whatever, and then turns off the power supply. What happens when you hit the trip current, John? Go ahead.
Yes, on this machine, because of the life safety issues, it shuts completely down. It trips out the DC, it automatically puts a discharge resistor across it, and shuts the AC supply off and trips the breaker, all automatically.
So in other words, if you were testing the high voltage breakdown of a transformer, and you hit the trip current, it would shut itself down immediately so as not to create any further damage to that transformer you're testing. That's what I think it's doing. And you have to visually catch what current it was at or what voltage it was at. Does it record in any way what the breakdown voltage or breakdown current was? The breakdown current is going to be your trip current. Does it record in any way what the voltage was that created the breakdown?
No, it's not recording. You adjust that slowly. You bring the voltage up as you watch the ammeter. And that it does not record the voltage. You know the voltage because you're watching the meter as it goes up.
Okay, you're watching a voltmeter. Does that voltmeter have various scales? Can you set it for 1,000 volts full scale, 10,000 volts full scale, 100,000 volts full scale? Over to you, John.
Yes, you can. In 5 steps, I believe it is, you can set the voltage range of your particular pot. As you bring the pot up, you'll see the meter start to swing up, and as you get to full scale, it will give you a warning that you have to change your range switch.
Okay, so the maximum range is 0 to 100,000 volts on that voltmeter. What's the minimum range on that voltmeter, John?
Oh, I can go from 0 right up to 100,000 just by changing the range selector switch. I mean, seeing like 10 volts on it, you can read 10 volts with no problem.
Okay, so A full-scale deflection on the voltmeter in the most sensitive mode, is that 0 to 10 volts or is it 0 to 100 volts? Over to you, John.
Yes, 0 to 100 volts.
And I presume the owner's manual says that whatever you set the trip current for, the machine will never exceed that amount of current through the device on the test, therefore you're limiting the damage. Is that true?
Yes, it is. And it does also have a chart recorder output. If you wanted to do that, then that would be your recorded record. So I guess you could, you would have a paper copy of your current.
It sounds to me like the average guy uses it where he's creeping up slowly on the voltage, he's looking at the voltmeter, he's remembering the last voltage it went at before the trip. And in your case, when you did trip with the two sharp points, which I'm sure you generated, the machine didn't come that way. My guess is they don't recommend you use two sharp points, is my pure guess. That you were able to get enough current through the glass that you heard a large zap. That worries me a little bit, because if that took place internal to a high-voltage transformer that you're testing the secondary winding to the core leakage, for instance, that zap that you heard could do some damage. It would burn up the enamel on that wiring, so to speak. So I'm a little bit amazed that before you hit the trip voltage current, it made this large zap. Over to you, John.
KC2WGV. Yeah, don't forget that zap was coming from the arc itself, but this machine is very rugged, very built just for this particular job. You can take those two probes while you're at 100,000. You could short them if you put on your gloves, safety gloves, and you could just short them together, and nothing will happen to that machine. Excellent piece of equipment.
You're telling me you have safety vault, you have safety gloves that you trust to 100,000 volts. Did I hear you say that, Sean? Go ahead.
Yes, I have high voltage gloves, the highest rating ones, which are good for around 60,000 volts, very high. And then there's the rubber boots that go on the cable, and that's how you would short it. And that's what you use along with the flash chute when you're doing job, you know, when we're on the job. But in the lab, I don't use the flash chute, of course.
Now, on my particular high-voltage machine, I've got two plastic handles on the high-voltage probes, and I can grab those plastic handles, and I'm isolated from the high-voltage probes, and I can swing them, so to speak. Do your probes have something similar to that, or are you always touching metal when you're moving your probes? Go ahead.
On the normal job, one cable, which is the ground cable, has a device similar to a welder's ground screw. It's a clamp that goes on and there's a screw that tightens down. The other one is a well-insulated and booted, looks like the old battery clips from years ago, approximately an inch wide. That's the cables that you would use for testing high-voltage insulators and things like that. I had to make a little conversion adapter to bring it over to my little pins. And no, they don't recommend that you use the machine with pins.
The machine comes with these 1.5-inch bulbous devices?
No, that's another thing I had gotten from Edmund Scientific.
Edmund intended those to be used for what purpose, John?
It was nondescript. I had found them in their counter as I was going through their store. They had a whole bunch of them. And I just thought they would be good for that purpose. They look like they're stainless steel or Monel, and they even came with little elevated stands for the bench, so it worked out well.
I presume you bought this biddle on the surplus market, John? Boy, you're well equipped.
Well, negative. This was bought brand new right from biddle, and we used it on the job for years.
Oh, and it became surplus equipment at one time?
Well, we had a very special type of job where we had no cost limitations. Whatever we needed for the job, we just bought for that particular job and it was charged to it. And some of it became non-usable, and I wound up with some of it, quite a bit of it, in fact.
Very well done. That's nice. I think you said this is a 100-pound machine. runs on 110 or 220?
Oh, 110.
Is there a version of Biddle that goes beyond 100,000 volts?
Not that I'm aware of. I know they make one very popular that goes to 30,000. That's used in a lot of areas. But 100,000 are rough to find. I don't even know if they make it anymore.
Wesley, you said you had a question?
Yeah, I had a question. At first, I had a problem with coronal discharge. When you see the spark from one side and the other side of the glass, then for me, it is kind of obvious that it is spark going through the glass. Then I was thinking, glass. Well, the glass could be made with lead or any other metal component that makes that special nature of the glass.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, we're going to have to look up glass and find out what is the volts per centimeter that glass can tolerate. I know it's a pretty big number. And so I'm having trouble believing that your window glass broke down in that circumstance. I think it was a complicated kind of an air breakdown is my guess. And if you did the same experiment in a vacuum jar, I'm about to find out, hey, John, you got almost everything. You got a vacuum jar and a two-stage vacuum pump? Over to you, John.
I have a mercury pump and a regular vacuum pump, but I broke my bell jar.
I thought so. Now, I own a two-stage vacuum pump, so I forget how many microns. I think it can go down to 10 microns or something like that. And I own a cage-like device with a flat door in the front that you can open up, and I can put vacuum inside of that, although I haven't done it yet. So, in theory, I can run vacuum experiments. How I would get a high-voltage probe inside that cage, which I think is a conductive box. Right now, I don't know. So you had a bell jar, and you're saying it got broken. Out of curiosity, what happened there, John?
I was taking it to a demonstration, and I dropped it out of my truck. And it was one of the old ones with the nice wooden base with the brass ring. It was really a charming-looking thing. It was around 16 inches in diameter, too. It was nice.
Wow. What would it cost to replace that particular piece of glass, John?
Dick, I tried to find it, and I guess if I went to a scientific company, I went to Edmund, and they had smaller ones, but nothing that would fit. I really don't know, but now I threw the base out, so maybe I'll buy another one someday.
I think you said the base was wood. How do you get a vacuum held with a piece of wood, John?
Dick, it had a nice mahogany or walnut base, and there was a brass metal ring, which was the seal, and a total brass bottom that was within the bell jar itself, and the gasket it sat on. It was really well made. It was like from, I guess, the 40s. It was really old.
When you used that, were you sealing it with vacuum grease?
Well, I was using Vaseline, if that can be considered vacuum grease. I also tried using it for a cloud chamber, but it didn't work out too well.
Well, the Vaseline experiment, Vaseline has a whole lot of stuff that outgasses. They make a special kind of vacuum grease, which is known to be very low on outgassing. You have to carefully choose the grease that you use for seals if you're doing a very high voltage, high current, high vacuum experiment. The best vacuum pump you've got can go down to what kind of vacuum, John?
Dick, I don't remember. I haven't used it in so long. But I know it goes down to, let me see if I can remember what the atmospheric level was. Let me take a look at my notes. I'll be right back.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, actually, many things came up into my mind. One of them was the RF cage or the Faraday cage. I was shopping for that. The prices are extreme. There was one made for the cell phones, but it wasn't expensive. But somehow I oversleep that. It was for $400, and it was purchased for $40. Yeah, that's a good thing about having that. But The question that I have is in different nature. When we were talking about the square wave and the spikes, then I say, hey, pulse generators. I've heard so many times that the pulse generators are not recommended for ham radio equipment. And then, yes, based on this explanation that I've got from you, it looks like, again, creating all of the unnecessary, unneeded spectrum of frequencies. Back to you.
Yeah, in theory, there are only certain ham bands where hams are allowed to use pulsed signals. I know that they're not allowed to use pulses on the 10 gigahertz band. I think they are allowed to on the 2, 3, and 5 gigahertz band and the 24 gig band. But the 10 gig band, which is known to be a radar band, in theory, we're not allowed to use pulses. Although, what constitutes a pulse and what constitutes high-speed Morse code is another interesting question. If I'm transmitting dots at 60 words a minute, is that a pulse generator or is that high-speed Morse code? One is allowed and the other is not. So you got a definition problem there, as you can tell. And in the case of the 10 gig ham band, the band is 500 megacycles wide, 10.0 to 10.5 gigahertz. You would be very hard-pressed to make a pulse generator where the pulses are so brief in their rise and fall time and rep rate and whatever that you would fall outside of that band, 500 megacycles wide. Not to worry. And some of the other microwave bands are also very wide. So hams have, way back in the late 50s and early 60s, the California hams of the San Bernardino Microwave Society, of which I was a member, not then, but I've been a member later, they were doing pulse measurements. Some of their very first microwave work was done with pulsed signal generators. KQLIW listening.
I can't find the Pascal reading of those pumps, but I will get it, Dick. I'll let you know.
Of the same nature, switching power supplies. I've heard also that they are not very much recommended for the ham radio transceiver. Back to you.
Not true. There are switching regulator power supplies, particularly the one that's in the December issue, 1999 QST magazine, the lead article. Very well-designed switching regulator. So, yes, some of the switching regulators that were used on compact pieces of ham equipment where the switching power supply was of poor design and it either had failure modes or made extra harmonics, extra spurious signals coming out of the transmitter, there's a large number of ways you can make a poorly designed switching regulator. That doesn't mean all switching regulators are bad. Some ham pieces of equipment have switching power supplies that work very well. So I guess the bottom line is you've got to be a little bit careful in the one you choose. I'm going to have to leave you guys. That was TechNet number 1349. Let's see if we put Mel to sleep. If he stays up this late, wow, that guy is rugged. K2KEY, K2RAW, go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, I just like to sit and listen and relax and get ready for bed. I got an early morning tomorrow, but I know if I stay up and all this way I go to sleep and get some rest. So all is well. We'll do it again next week. Unless the prediction comes true that the 21st, oh well. Anyhow, just reading about that 21st as Armageddon. Okay, not see you next week, everybody. Thank you all. 73, have a great week. This is K2KEY saying good night.
21st of December, Mel.
That was his first prediction. Harold Campion is now making a second prediction. I think it's next Saturday at the... Is it 6 in the morning or 6 at night? I'm not sure which. The world's going to come to an end. And not everybody is so sure that that's going to happen, but this televangelist, Harold Campion, is making that prediction.
I have to move now, Dick?
I'm not sure what you got to do to defend yourself.
The Dick, shortly, they say, how come the isolator and circulator in Harry's Fermion device could exist at the same time?
An isolator and a circulator are both the exact same machine.
The ferrite components and the magnetic components in it. And for me, it's kind of... I don't get it.
Yeah, we're going to have to pick up a circulator. That's a pretty long discussion. We'll pick up circulators next week, but a circulator, a three-port circulator, with a termination on the third port, is called an isolator. It's just a matter of terminology. Be kind to each other. 73, you all. We'll be back next week, and we'll discuss more of this jazz. K2RAW, clear, and bye-bye for now.
Good night, Dick. Good night, Mel.
TV set is a form of pulse modulation. What kind of a TV set is a pulse modulation? Oh, you mean the digital TV that we got now? Okay. What's the duty factor of that pulse modulation?
Very.
Depending on what the picture is being sent. Bye-bye. Are you in transit right now? Are you mobile?
I am. Have a good night, Dick. K2RAW, K2 guy.
Bye-bye, you all.
Thank you very much, Dick, for a beautiful night that you have made to us, and I was delighted, and I'm sorry that I was dragging you on this subject, but was but good. Thank you very much. John, can you move to 147?
Yeah, Wes, I got a few more minutes left. KC2WGB, QSY, 147.
2XJN, QSY, 147.
Tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system.